Well, a few days ago, the Cuban Communist Party held its sixth National Congress. This is the first Congress in 14 years, so the last one was held in 1997. And the reason for finally convoking this Congress is that the leadership of the Cuban state wants to implement a whole plethora of economic changes to the way that the Cuban economy works. And in that conference, which just happened a few days ago, the reports are, although like the exact content of what was decided on hasn't been released just yet, but the reports are that the 311 reform package, point package, was voted on, unsurprisingly, unanimously. Okay, so these changes to the economy are, as always, being driven from the top of Cuban society, and in particular by Raúl Castro. Now, Raúl Castro has taken over as president of the Cuban state since 2006. He did that unofficially in 2006 and then officially in 2008. And this is to take over from his brother, Fidel, who's been quite sick and ailing. And so he's sort of the sort of youthful brother at the age of 80 who's taken his place. He's now out of that Congress. He's also been voted the first secretary of the Cuban Communist Party as well, replacing Fidel. Okay, so Raúl has said that he wants to update their so-called socialist economy. And this involves really implementing what I think is a Thatcherite neoliberal policy of rationalization. It involves the slashing of state jobs and the winding back of its welfare programs to achieve what some of the supporters of the regime on the international left have called making a more efficient socialism. On top of these cutbacks, they're trying to provide greater openings to private enterprise, and also increased, they're trying to sort of seek out more and more foreign investment. But while the Cuban regime is clearly heading down the path of more and more opening up the economy to private enterprise, and to the free market, the Cuban regime is not really proposing a total opening to the free market. Really, what they're trying to do, I think, is maintain essentially the framework of state capitalism, but grafting on greater role for the private sector. So at the moment, something like 90% of the economy is still controlled by the state in Cuba. 80% to 85% of employment is state employment, and only 6% of investment in the Cuban economy is from foreign investment. So the reforms that are being proposed are really just going to dent that reality. And that's why I think it's a milestone what's happening in Cuba, but it's only sort of one of many sort of steps along the way to opening up to the free market. Okay, I want to spend a little time looking at the background of these economic reforms before I go on to more of the detail of what the Cuban state is actually proposing. The Cuban economy, the background really is a struggling Cuban economy, and it's been struggling really since the collapse of the USSR, which was its main trading partner until the early 90s. And the collapse of the USSR had a really devastating impact on the Cuban economy. Between 1990 and 1993, the economy went down by, national output went down by about 36%. And this period of the 90s is known as the special period. It's really a period of great hardship when tractors were replaced by the ox in agriculture, horse-drawn carts, returned to the streets. But also prostitution returned, a massive increase in inequality and so on. Food and fuel shortages in this period produce widespread malnutrition amongst Cubans and also constant blackouts. So it was a really difficult period. During this period, the Americans also tightened its criminal trade embargo on the Cuban state in an attempt to really engineer or try and force a regime change. And this blockade has been in place really since 1960, and it's been in place to punish the Cubans for daring to overthrow a US-backed dictatorship and for daring to slip the leash of US domination in what it regards as its backyard. And before I move on, I just want to underscore that whatever Socialist Alternative thinks about the class character of the Cuban regime, that it has nothing to do with socialism, we absolutely and unequivocally oppose the US's interventions and aggression towards Cuba. Like we oppose all other US imperialist interventions around the world. We call for the unconditional an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. We call for the cessation of aid to, you know, right-wing regimes like the Colombian regime, the Israeli government, and so on. So this is part of our anti-imperialist positions. We support Cuba's rights to self-determination. Okay, so Cuba survived the terrible 90s and defied the widespread predictions at the time that the Cuban state was about to collapse. And part of the reason why they survived is that, unlike the other so-called communist regimes in the Eastern Bloc, the Cuban regime was a product of a homegrown popular revolution. And it did introduce some important reforms, like subsidized housing, guaranteed jobs, until now, free healthcare and education, giving the new regime really a great deal of legitimacy in the eyes of many Cubans. At the same time, the ongoing American aggression against Cuba also won it nationalist backing from a lot of Cubans who, you know, could remember, had the historical memories of what, you know, U.S. domination over Cuba meant for Cubans. It meant turning the country into a casino run by the mafia and a brothel. So, part of what sort of held glued people to Castro has been things like the blockade and U.S. Aggression. Okay, to deal with the economic crisis of the 1990s, Fidel moved to increasingly embrace sections of Western capitalism. He, for instance, allowed a limited number of foreign investment in the country, especially in the tourism industry. So he sort of started to seek out joint ventures between the Cuban state and foreign capital. And this was on very favourable terms to foreign capital. They could own 49% of the joint ventures, they could hire foreign executives, and they could they were pretty much exempt from all taxes, and they could repatriate all of their profits in hard currency. This period, he also established free trade zones, or they're called maquiladoras in the rest of the region. And he also allowed for a limited amount of self-employment. So there was something like 140,000 self-employment licenses that were granted this time. On top of this, he legalized the American dollar to take advantage of the remittances that were being kind of funneling into the country from Cuban exile families and so on. And this is where you start seeing the establishment of the dollar shops, so that if you don't have access to the dollar, you don't have family living overseas giving you money, sending you money, then you really don't have access to a whole lot of consumer goods. So this is a period where you see quite a big expansion of inequality, something like 10% increase during this period. Okay, so all of this back history is useful to know because it tells us that the current reforms are really only the latest step in a long road. It's only the sort of, it's not the first opening to the free market. Another factor when we're sort of thinking about how the economy got out of its deep crisis of the 90s was also obviously the relationship that they've developed with Venezuela. So since 2000 and then especially since 2005, there's been a commercial relationship between Venezuela and Cuba where in exchange for Cuban doctors, they've gotten quite a lot of Venezuelan subsidized oil. So this has really helped with the fuel shortages. I think often this relationship is portrayed as just about, you know, international solidarity. But I think that it is important to see that this is not, without any self-interest that Cuba's giving these doctors. It's an important, important source of trade. It's a commercial relationship, really. Okay, so when Raul took over as president in 2006, the push for reform that already sort of begun under Fidel really accelerated, and this came as no surprise to anyone because Raul, before taking over as president, had talked quite a lot about singing the praises of the Chinese model. The Chinese model being the extensive marketization of the economy with the maintenance of a very authoritarian state structure. And in 2005, when he visited Shanghai, he said to his hosts, I quote, "It is truly encouraging, everything that you have done here. You have confirmed something that we say over there in Latin America, that is, that a better world is possible." Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, really quite an obscene statement to describe China with its obscene wealth disparities, you know, with the hyper-exploitation of the Chinese working class, to say that this is the kind of society that Cuba, you know, regards as the alternative, and obviously also to appropriate the language of the anti-capitalist movement, another world is possible, to describe this state of affairs. Okay, so despite these early reforms that both the Castros introduced in the 1990s and then again throughout the 2000s, the Cuban economy is once again back in the pits. There's a range of reasons for this. They have a lot of international debt. They find it very hard to get credit. They can't access a lot of international credit. And the credit they can get is like at 22% or something like that, interest rates. There's also obviously the questions of this sort of bureaucratic inefficiencies of the state-run economy, a lot of waste and so on. But the main reason why the economy is back in the doldrums is the world economic crisis. And so the world economic crisis had quite a negative impact on the economy. It led to a loss of income over tourism. So although they have the same amount of tourists coming to Cuba, 2.4 million a year, I think, those tourists are spending a lot less money on the sort of their luxury tourist packages. Also, there's been a decrease in the remittances that have been sent from Cuban exile families to their families in Cuba. And another big thing has been there was quite a dramatic drop in the price of nickel, which something like 47% loss of income from nickel in 1 year because that commodity on the world market plummeted at the start of the world economic crisis. It has sort of recovered somewhat, but it's not recovered at all to the rate that it was before then. And nickel, like most people when they think of Cuba, they think of sugar. But nickel actually had surpassed not just sugar, but also tourism as the most important earner for the regime in the lead up to the economic crisis. So it's quite an important part of the Cuban economy. On top of this, obviously, the sugar industry is in absolute disarray. So the historic kind of sector of the economy that they've been absolutely dependent on to sort of get export earnings is in disarray. It's in such disarray that at some points they haven't actually been able to fulfill their contracts to foreign companies. So, you know, they've actually had to import sugar to be able to get enough sugar to fulfill these contracts. So that says something about the state of the sugar industry. And so it's meant that something like 50% of agricultural land in Cuba is idle and actually going fallow. And one of the early reforms that Castro Raul introduced was to boost agricultural production, he started a process of leasing out some of this land to private farmers and to cooperatives in the hope that they would be able to reduce their reliance on food imports. Something like 80% of all food in Cuba is imported from overseas. And interestingly, 25 to 35% of that food is from America, despite the blockade. So, you know, Midwestern farmers send their wheat and so on. But this process so far hasn't resulted in increased food production. Actually, 2010 saw a decrease in food production on the year before. So, yeah, that's not really helping. All right, so I want to move on now to discuss some of the detail of the current reforms. The real centerpiece of the economic reforms is the slashing of state sector jobs. And the figures are really quite dramatic. Raul has said that there is an excess 1.3 million jobs, million workers in the Cuban economy. And so the aim is to shed 1.3 million jobs. That's 20% of the Cuban workforce. And he wants to cut these over the next 5 years. In a speech I think smacked of neoliberalism's emphasis on personal responsibility and hard work, Raul Castro declared his determination to, and I quote, erase forever the notion that Cuba is the only country in the world where one can live without working. Indeed, I think this speech sounded eerily similar to Julia Gillard's speech that she just delivered attacking welfare recipients when she said that Australians need to learn a new culture of work. On top of the slashing of state jobs, Raul is also attempting to end what he calls the excessive subsidies and improper gratuities to Cuban workers. So really, they're wanting to end Cuba's iron rice bowl, to use sort of the Chinese example. They're wanting to wind back the social benefits and the welfare that Cuban workers have really absolutely depended on to survive when they've been making such a measly wage. They make something like $20 American equivalent per month. So they've really relied on the sort of the ration books, the free healthcare, the free education and so on just to survive. Already, Raul, before these reforms, actually moved to cut back on these improper gratuities when he ordered last year to close down workplace canteens. So there have been canteens that have been providing free lunch to workers, and that all of those were closed down, I think, last year. Or it might have been 2008. The reforms also call for the elimination of the ration book, the Libretta, which has been in place since 1962. This is not the first attack on the ration book, which entitles all Cubans to a set of heavily subsidized basic foodstuff. It's been becoming more and more stingy over the past two decades. So really the provisions at the moment in the ration book only really cover something like one or best 2 weeks in the month. On top of this, the quality of the food in these state stores is becoming more and more lacking in quality. So I read actually that beef is no longer beef. If you want to get beef, it's now a ground mixture of soy, bean and beef all ground up together. And there's also less and less items available on the ration book. Most consumer goods like clothes, toys, household goods and so on are no longer available through the ration book like they were before the 1990s. So that got cut, over 10 years ago. If you want to buy these things, you need to buy them in shops that only sell them in exchange for the convertible peso, which is Cuba's second currency. So they have a dual currency system. One is the Cuban peso and the other one is the convertible peso. It's sort of like a dollarized peso. And the only way you can get access to this is if you work in the tourism industry, you can get access to that from tips. Though if you have a job with some like joint venture firm or whatever, you still get paid in Cuban pesos. You might get through the remittances. So, your family send you dollars and then you exchange them, for convertible currency. Of course, if you're in positions of power, you can get access to the convertible currency and, you know, prostitution and so on is another way that people have gotten access to this. Something like 60% of Cubans have varying degrees of access to the convertible currency. So that means that 40% of all Cubans have no access at all to this currency. And disproportionately, it's Afro-Cubans who don't have access to these things. They have less family that live overseas. And also, because of hiring practices, which I think probably reveals a deal with racism in Cuban society, a lot of blacks can't get jobs in the tourism industry. They want to hire whites to interact with the foreign tourists. So without the canteens, without the ration books and so on, life is set to get a lot harder for these people in Cuba. On top of this, there's absolute deficiency of public transport. Housing is absolutely dilapidated. I read something like 300 or so buildings in Havana per year collapse or have partial collapses, so very unsafe situation for buildings. And the education and healthcare system, while they've maintained them as universally free, they've been really underfunded and deteriorating. So the quality of the service is a lot less. Access to medicines, very hard. There's a lot of shortages in medicines and so on. Okay, Raul has claimed that no one will be left behind by these reforms, but I really think that these are empty words. And I think they hide the fact that, or they try to, not very well, hide the fact that what Cuba is doing is carrying out the same kind of austerity measures that all other capitalist governments are implementing throughout the world. Cuba, along with Greece, Spain, Britain, and so on, are all attempting to deal with the economic crisis by putting the burden on the backs of working class people. I think it's no different in Cuba than anywhere else. Okay, so what's been proposed to be done with these excess workers? Well, the government hopes that a lot of these workers will be absorbed into the private sector. Raul is making available another 250,000 self-employment licenses for things like setting up food stalls or family restaurants on your porch of your house or taxis and so on. It also includes things like, supposedly this is a profession, filling cigarette lighters with fluid. You can get an employment license for that. Being an attendant at a public bathroom, so presumably these people will work for tips like they do in America. Shining shoes or tuning instruments. So, like, clearly none of these things are really going to be the engines of growth in the Cuban economy. But they hope that it'll, take some of the pressure off, obviously, from state finances. The government is also relaxing laws forbidding these small businesses from being able to employ labour. So previously you couldn't employ any labour other than your family could do some work. Now they're allowing these small businesses to hire workers and therefore exploit their labour. So what the Cuban state is really doing, I think, is legalising for the first time since 1969 petty bourgeoisie in Cuba. So in 1969, they nationalized all small businesses, everything, which really went beyond where a lot of the sort of state-run economies went. They totally wiped out any economic activity outside of the control of the state. The government is also proposing that at least 200,000 of these workers will be absorbed into the cooperative system. So the cooperative system is where like the government hands over small state-run firms like beauty parlours to the workers, and so the government no longer has any responsibility for their operation. It sounds all nice and good, and the Cuban state, you know, hopes, I think, that this will not just save them money, but will be something that will boost productivity. That a lot of the problems in the Cuban economy are really lack of productivity. People feel totally alienated, they've got no control over their workplace, and so that this will sort of give them some sense of you know, control. But really, I think that this is going to be about increasing the exploitation of these workers, and they're going to be the ones driving it. Because if you're a co-op and you've got no longer any guaranteed income coming in, then it's the profits that co-op makes that has to be responsible for paying the wages of these workers. So that's where the kind of like, you know, the sort of the whip is. But if you don't get access to credit to be able to buy imports and stuff for your to like machinery or, you know, stuff for the warehouse or whatever, for that little business to run, if you can't get access to credit or those things, then, you know, your co-op isn't going to go very well, and you're going to have to start thinking about who are you going to lay off, you know, which wages are you going to cut, and, you know, potentially a lot of these will fail. And I think that is the thought, like some of these will fail, and it's really unclear what's going to happen to these workers. There's no plan yet. So when these co-ops fail, these people will be like provided for. So a lot of that's still very vague. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. Of course, another big part of the reforms proposed is to seek out greater foreign investment. In 2009, there were already 218 joint ventures and partnership agreements in Cuba. And these investments tended to be in the tourism sector, particularly with European companies paving the way. So joint ventures between perhaps the Cuban military and some European company. And so they've set up golf courses, luxurious tourist villas, they're building marinas and so on along up and down the coastline. Interesting about tourism, one of reforms of RAL was to finally allow Cubans to actually go to these tourist hotels before they were banned. So there was kind of this like national apartheid in tourism. But of course, like who the fuck can afford to go to these hotels? Some of them, if you're on $20 a month, it's going to probably take nearly a whole year's wage just to provide to pay for like one night in some of these hotels. So for most Cubans, being allowed to go to a tourist hotel doesn't mean very much. There's also a lot of foreign investment in the nickel industry, particularly by China. The country's telephone system is partly owned by an Italian communications company, and the Havana's water system is run by a public-private partnership with a Spanish company. And interestingly, even though Cuba claims to be, you know, a supporter of the Palestinian cause, the largest citrus grove and juice company in Cuba is a joint venture between the Cuban state and Israeli capital. The CEO of the Israeli capital, the Israeli company, is Rafi Eitan. And he was, in fact, a former chief of Mossad's operations in Europe. So, nice guy. Interestingly, the Cuban military is playing a very prominent role, a very big role in the joint venture sector of the economy. So, for instance, the biggest tourism company, the single biggest tourism company in Cuba is Gaviota, which is a subsidiary of the Cuban military. And these generals in business suits are increasingly being integrated into world capitalist circles, obviously not American capitalist circles just yet, but nonetheless, they wine and dine, do deals, you know, run their companies in order to, for profit and so on. And so one of the things that Raul has also done to sort of elevate the role of the military in the economy. It's not just the joint ventures that of the military's own corporations, but they're also running a lot of the state-run firms as well. So the sugar industry, for instance, is run by a person from the military. He's also elevated a lot of the military to positions of power within the government. So there was a vice president recently that was elevated who was a general. And in a number of speeches and articles that the Cuban Trotskyist Samuel Fava has written, he's sort of pointed out that these military figures, these generals in business suits, combined with the civilian managers and technocrats, he thinks will provide a very important layer in the future who will, increasingly push for greater and greater openings to the free market. That, you know, they're the closet neoliberals in the Cuban state. Obviously, they would benefit from greater openings. As I said earlier, these economic changes are being driven by the top echelons of the Cuban state. But some defenders of the regime disagree, and they want to point out that there's been a whole process of consultation that's gone on with these reforms. Indeed, there's been something like 7 million Cubans that have participated in discussions in neighborhoods and in local Communist Party branches. And these discussions have been centered on the 32-page booklet that the government put out called the Draft Guidelines for Economic and Social Reforms. But consultation is not democratic control by the people of Cuba over domestic economic policy. Far from it. And I really think the consultation can only be understood as the regime testing the water just to see if there's going to be any massive, you know, uproar or instability that caused as a result of implementing these reforms. And actually, there was an avalanche of criticisms that stemmed from these local meetings. People are very anxious and very worried about what the future might hold in Cuba. And this sort of avalanche, 1,619 suggestions for deletions, additions, and modifications supposedly came out of those meetings. But I think, yeah, so this concern has actually helped delay some of the cuts. So originally they wanted to implement 500,000 job cuts by March this year, and Raul had to announce it's all... You know, we're delaying that for now. It's going to happen over the next 5 years. And I think it's probably pretty likely that a lot of their concern and anxiety has to do with the context of the world situation at the moment, of the Middle East being in uproar, that, you know, dictatorial regimes that seemed impregnable, that you couldn't challenge them, all of a sudden are coming under enormous challenge from their population. You know, regimes that denied democratic rights, that have been implementing neoliberal attacks on working class living conditions over the last decades are being challenged. And I think they're probably worried that Cubans might get some ideas. For all the consultation that happened, there was no mechanism established for any of the things that came up in those discussions to be binding on the state, like ruling bodies. What's more, so like if you made a criticism, they may or may not take it into account, but there's no way that you can force them to do it. What's more, there was no mechanism to put forward an alternative program. So the discussions were all centered around the Cuban state's document. You couldn't put forward another program, say, let's debate that as well and see if if people support that instead. No. There can be no political criticism of the Cuban Communist Party's positions. In fact, they're the only legal political party in Cuba. And organizing a political current outside of and that challenges this party is illegal and is repressed. The lack of any genuine say over what is happening in Cuba, I think, was most obvious by the fact that the Raul announced that the cuts were going to happen, half of them were going to happen even before the Communist Party Congress happened and even before the consultation process happened. And indeed, a lot of the reforms are already in place. And this was something that Pedro Campos, he's a member of the Communist Party in Cuba and a historian, has pointed to, and he said, they presented the discussion on some guidelines whose key points had already been approved by the Council of Ministers, put into legislation, and now being executed as part of a 5-year plan that ignores the people and the party. I think this really reflects this whole sort of charade of democracy that the consultation process was, reflects the lack of democracy in the Cuban state. Many defenders of the Cuban state try and say, oh, there's a superior form of democracy in Cuba to Western democracy. And I would agree with a lot of their critiques of Western democracy, that it's a sham, that the rich and powerful are the ones who actually have control over the decision-making in this society. They're the ones who set the national priorities, not the citizens and so on. But the truth of the paucity of Western democracy shouldn't blind us to the fact that Cuba also has no democracy. Let's take a look at one of the main democratic structures in Cuba, what's called Poder Popular, and how this operates. This structure was set up in 1976, so quite a few years after the revolution, and it was introduced by the new constitution in 1976. And it was part of the whole, what they called, institutionalization process, that the guerrillas in power had lost touch with the base, with the masses, and now they had to, like, actually maybe set up some structures. Poder Popular establishes a whole series of assemblies, local, provincial, and a national assembly. And Samuel Faber, the Cuban Trotskyist, who now lives in exile, has labeled popular power a multi-level pseudo-parliament, and he describes it as democracy without any substance. And I think one of the most honest accounts of how so-called democracy works in Cuba was actually in a book by a supporter of the Cuban regime, D.L. Rabi, and this book was called Democracy and Revolution, Latin America and Socialism Today. And he writes that at the local level, elected municipal delegates are responsible for all local affairs. But then he makes an important qualification. Only within parameters laid down at a national level. Okay, so how are these national parameters, how are these parameters laid down? They're laid down by the National Assembly. So how is this National Assembly elected? Well, in the elections, there generally is only one candidate per position, so they're not contested. And these candidates, not anyone can run. You have to be selected by a candidates commission. Now, who runs these candidate commissions? It's the Communist Party representatives and representatives from the mass organisations like the Women's Federation and the Trade Union, also controlled by the Communist Party. And so Rabi says, the election is more like a popular ratification of a pre-selected list of candidates. What's more, these candidates are who are on these officially sanctioned slates aren't able to campaign. So if you're a candidate, you can only put forward your political biography, like what groups you've been a part of. You certainly cannot organise a group of you in opposition to the Communist Party. You can't organise around an alternative programme to the Communist Party and so on. But I think really, like, so obviously it's sham. It's not a democratic body. But really it's a moot point in some ways about how the National Assembly is elected, because they only meet twice a year. So they're not really a governing body in any sort of day-to-day sense. Instead, real power is held by a ruling council estate. And further to this, as Raby points out, he quotes, basic policy is decided by the Communist Party leadership. So the decisions of the council estate and the Communist Party leadership are then ratified by the National Assembly, which is why most votes in the National Assembly are unanimous. There's no debate. Obviously, meeting twice a year, though, is a lot better than what the Communist Party has managed in terms of their national congresses. So, as I said, the Congress on the weekend is now the sixth Congress. So in the 46 years of its existence, it's managed six Congresses. Indeed, it took 10 years for it to have, from its establishment in 1965, to have its first Congress. 10 whole years. Yeah, great. But don't worry, like, the Supreme Leader can interpret the will of the masses somehow without having any need to meet. While Cuba is no North Korea or Burma in terms of its political repression, any political opposition to the regime is carefully monitored and frequently suppressed, either through intimidation. So a lot of sort of dissidents or oppositionists have the security police staking out their home day in, day out. There's often threats of losing state employment. So that's pretty serious. If you think 80 to 85% of employment is with the state and you get sacked from your state job, that's really going to be hard to survive. And also there's these things called repudiation meetings, which still happen, where the state security forces basically organise citizens, bust them into a distant house, surround it and, like, yell insults at it, throw things at it. And then the media, like, videos it and puts it on state TV and presents it as, like, the organic anger of the Cuban masses against these people speaking out against the regime. So, yeah. Okay, but sometimes political opponents of the regime are actually imprisoned. It's not just the Miami-funded dissidents who are harassed. And throughout the period of of Cuba's history. There's been something like, in the 60s and 70s, it used to be 20,000 political prisoners at any one point. And some of these political prisoners were actually from the left, left-wing critics of the regime. And so Samuel Farber says that in the 1960s, a tiny group of Cuban Trotskyists were imprisoned for several years after their literature and printing press were seized by the government. This was a group that supported the Cuban Revolution. They were eventually released on condition that they cease independent political activity. And so today there's a lot less political prisoners. It's estimated that there's around 200 political prisoners in Cuba's jails. And a great majority of these people are jailed for activities of a peaceful nature. So you may not agree with some of their criticisms. A lot of them are pro-market liberals and so on. But they've been jailed for putting out dissident material. That's what they're being jailed for. A lot of the, in 2003, there was a big crackdown on some of these dissidents, and 27 of the 75 people that were jailed were journalists. Okay, these political prisoners are jailed alongside an enormous number of common prisoners. Indeed, Cuba has so many common prisoners that it has the unlucky title of having the fifth highest prison population per capita in the world, which is hardly a marker of a free society. Cubans also don't have the right to independent trade unions to defend their interests against the state or management. The only legal trade union federation is in Cuba is the state-run Cuban Confederation, which acts as all state-run union federations do. They don't act to defend the interests of workers. They're there to be the mouthpieces of management, to really try and, you know, increase discipline and productivity and so on in the workplace. And it should be remembered that the person actually that announced the initial layoffs, the 500,000 layoffs in September last year, was the head of the Trade Union Confederation. What's more, strikes are illegal in Cuba. Just as Cuban workers don't exercise any control over the Cuban Cuba's domestic economic policy, they also have no control over the country's foreign policy. This stuff doesn't even get really discussed. You know, at least they had consultation for the domestic policy. There's not even any of that for the foreign policy. So workers have no control over the Cuban regime's attitude to the dictatorships or relationships to the dictatorships in the Middle East, and they have no control of what they say about the revolutions that are unfolding against these dictatorships. This was particularly stark in the instance of Libya, which has been a long-standing ally of Castro. When the rising against Colonel Gaddafi happened in February this year, which was inspired by the movements in Tunisia and Egypt, Fidel Castro refused to support the popular movement, saying that it was too early to criticise Gaddafi, and he was silent when Gaddafi was strafing and bombing protesters who were demanding democracy. And I think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, all of the lack of democracy in Cuba is because of the blockade and they can't open up, and, you know, obviously the international situation was better. But you think, there's a revolution going on. If you were actually interested in, ending your isolation, this is the biggest moment for hope at the moment that's happened in the last 30 years, and you're backing the dictatorships. And it's not the only shocking example of Cuban foreign policy. 2009, Castro disgracefully gave public backing to the Sri Lankan government when it was carpet bombing Tamil areas. After all, you wouldn't want to upset trading relationships. And basically, Cuba's rulers determine their foreign policy in the same way that every other capitalist ruler does, on the basis of what advances their own national interests. And there is nothing new about this. When the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968 to crush the Prague Spring, whose side do you think Castro was on? He called the protesters counter-revolutionaries, and in return, the Russians repaid him with immediate increase in aid. In 1968, again, when the right-wing Mexican regime massacred students who were protesting during the Olympic Games, Castro was silent. Again, this right-wing regime was an important ally. So these are a few examples of Cuba's international solidarity. Okay, so why spend all this time going through the lack of democratic control that Cubans exercise over domestic and foreign policy? Well, I think it tells us pretty conclusively that what is happening in Cuba is not that the Cuban regime is creating a more efficient socialism. Socialism, which is about the mass of workers democratically and collectively exercising control over all aspects of society, that sort of society does not exist and has never existed in Cuba. As Karl Marx argued, socialism can only be the product of the conscious self-activity of the mass of workers, that it has to come about through the actions of workers themselves who create their own institutions for running society in the process of challenging their rulers. This is precisely what's happened in all mass revolutionary upheavals that have involved workers. Workers have set up workers' councils, organs to democratically run society. But in 1959, during the Cuban Revolution and its aftermath, they never produced anything even approximating workers' councils or organs of workers' power. Basically, the Cuban state is the product of a revolution that was carried out by a few hundred, or at best a few thousand, guerrillas. While the guerrilla struggle against the hated US-backed dictatorship was a very popular struggle, it was supported by the mass of the Cuban population. What is striking about the Cuban Revolution is the very general and widespread lack of self-activity of workers or indeed peasants in this revolution. There was no forcible entrance of the masses onto the stage of history, to paraphrase Trotsky. Indeed, Castro actually opposed some of the initiatives from the base. When peasants were starting to do land seizures, he denounced them and said that any provocation to distributions of land is criminal. Okay, so obviously this has implications for the kind of democracy that flows from the revolution. In Cuba, it meant that Fidel Castro substituted the highly centralized and authoritarian guerrilla command structure in the vacuum that was left by the collapse of the Batista regime. Castro himself made no pretenses to being a socialist in the immediate aftermath of the revolution. On January 22, 1959, he declared, "I want to make it clear now that I am not a communist." That's after the revolution. Okay. But in December 1961, he had undergone a miraculous conversion, and now he declared, "I am a Marxist-Leninist and will remain so until the end of my days." All of a sudden, the Cuban Revolution was now a socialist revolution behind the backs of the mass of people. He declared it to be so. And clearly what provoked this conversion to socialism had nothing to do with what was really going on inside the Cuban Revolution in terms of transformations, the way that production was organized and so on. It had to do with U.S. aggression and things like the Bay of Pigs, the trade embargo, and also then the need for Cuba to align itself to the Soviet bloc, which called itself socialist but was nothing of the sort. And so then it imposed the sort of Stalinist state-run model from then on. All of this is important because it means that what Raul is doing is they're not updating the Cuba's socialist economy because Cuba was never socialist. So it's not a transformation from socialism to capitalism that's going on. Cuba is a capitalist society, albeit that the state plays the directing role in the economy. What the ruling class in Cuba are attempting to do is deal with their economic problems by modifying their state capitalist economy. They are merely following the well-trodden path of a lot of other statized economies that have happened over the last couple of decades, where they've more or less opened up to the free market. And in particular, one of the models that they're trying to emulate is China. And I say hoping to emulate because it's very unlikely, really, that they'll be able to emulate any of the China miracle. Cuba is a small country. It doesn't have the internal resources that China has. And Chinese state was able to mobilize these resources to really forcefully build up its industry and force its way onto the world economy. Cuba doesn't have anything of the sort. I really think the successes of the Chinese model that they're likely to emulate is the inequality that exists in China. One result of the poverty and inequality that has marred Cuban society, especially for the last two decades, has been rampant theft from workplaces and state warehouses. Workers in Cuba are stealing for a number of reasons. Poverty is one of them, so they steal from the warehouses to sell on the black market to make some more money. However, poverty is only one factor involved in all of this theft. A lot of it is also to do with the alienation that workers experience in Cuba. And this was from an article that was on Havana Times, which is a website that does carry some of these dissident articles. It was by a guy called Ron Ridenour, who's considered a friend of the regime. And he said that workers' lack of real decision-making power produces rampant demoralization, apathy, and cynicism and alienation, which results in endemic thievery. And apathy of the younger generation is a constant theme in Cuba. A lot of people write about how apathetic the Cuban youth are. And one of the Cuban communists actually wrote last year, The experience of the current generation of youth is practically limited to the special period, with its shortages, inequalities, and the profound economic, political, and social contradictions that originated within Cuban society, which has affected, even to a greater or lesser extent, our beautiful and sacred daughters, healthcare and education. To this generation, the speeches about justice and welfare of the revolution often have no basis in reality, or even worse, are moth-eaten old slogans, worn out and hackneyed. Of course, it's not just alienated youth and workers who are stealing. There's rampant corruption and stealing that's going on at the top echelon of society. So much so, like, there's been a lot of top officials that have been sacked for corruption. And there was another communist who actually wrote about, denouncing this corruption, said that this was the true counter-revolution in Cuba. And for his services, he was actually expelled from the party. So this increasingly open corruption and nepotism at the top, combined with poverty, political repression, the rising levels of inequality, all put pressure on the regime. They have less and less legitimacy and moral authority, especially with the younger generation. The question obviously arises about whether this discontent will translate into open, active opposition to the regime. Now, obviously, we can't predict whether this will lead to open revolt. Most of the political opposition in Cuba is weak or non-existent, or that exists is the pro-market liberals, though there are some individual left-wing voices that have critiqued the regime from the left. But these are pretty insignificant. But this weakness of the opposition was also true in many of the Middle Eastern countries as well. You think of Syria, they hadn't witnessed, Assad could say quite confidently, it's not going to happen here, because there hadn't been a lot of, opposition and protests and so on. I think we also have to put into the equation of wondering whether there'll be revolt is the fact that the more and more that the economy is integrated into the world economy, this imports a lot of instability as well as the world economy goes up and down. And so that can also be something that can help crack the monolith. So I think that the objective conditions are starting to develop for the potential for there to be protest, but wouldn't want to predict anything. But already I think the questions of taking sides in Cuba are already there. Workers are under attack by the Cuban regime. Whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the state capitalist regime who are trying to preserve their positions of power by dealing with the world economic crisis by imposing the burden on workers? Or are you on the side of workers in Cuba? And I think that this question of whose side you're on will become more and more important if there is protest and if there is upheavals. Will you be someone who's denouncing those workers and protesters as being counter-revolutionaries, as threatening the gains of the Cuban Revolution, or will you side with the workers who are taking a stand for their rights? And I'll end it there.